G'day, wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for your company once again on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. Now, many listeners will know that this is the first time that I've done a Truth To You program since the tragic loss of my firstborn son, Jonah Samuel Jonathan Vandoor, of blessed memory, just 5 months ago. So I'd like to take this opportunity to sincerely thank those of you who contributed to his being laid to rest in the Hebrew section of Doveton Park Cemetery, Ballarat, where he was given an honourable and dignified Jewish burial by the Ballarat Hebrew congregation. Your generosity and prayers have been deeply moving, so thank you, dear listeners. Jonah, my son, visited Israel for his 13th birthday in 2015. He was an avid student of Israeli battles and a proud supporter of the IDF. He himself was a keen army cadet. I don't pretend to even know 2% of the vast knowledge that he had amassed on such topics. I miss him dearly, of course, every day. It's very difficult. And for this reason, it seemed appropriate to return to Truth To You in 2018 with a new guest and someone with whom Jonah was very familiar. Joining me is a fellow Israel News Talk Radio host. His weekly show is entitled Bulletproof. He's also the co-host of a weekly television program on ILTV entitled Israeli Frenemies. He is a sergeant in an IDF Reserve's elite paratroopers unit and the assistant director of Standing Together, an organization that supports IDF soldiers. Welcome to the program for the first time, Ari Fuld.
Hey, John, thank you for having me. Really appreciate you having me on the program.
It's a pleasure to have you on, my friend, and it's good to talk to you again. The last time that we spoke face-to-face was, oddly enough, in Australia. I just returned from Israel on the tour that we do every year, and lo and behold, you were here. We met in Melbourne, and you were giving a talk in regards to Standing Together, and I'd like to get to that a little later on. But first, my friend, could you describe the two shows that I mentioned, starting with Bulletproof on Israel News Talk Radio? What is it about? What is the agenda of Bulletproof?
Sure, I'd be happy to explain to you. First, I want to say hello to all your listeners, and of course, my condolences for your loss. You know, in Judaism, we say that may God, you know, console you with the rest of the people who are mourning in the nation of Israel. May we not know any more sorrow.
Thank you, man.
So, you know, where do I start? Wow. So, you know, all those listening, hold on to your seats. It's going to be quite a ride. Yeah, I was born and raised in New York, and I came to Israel in 1991. I drafted to the IDF. I lost my second gunner who was kidnapped and murdered by terrorists. I actually found him. We found the terrorists and arrested them. And throughout the years, I was serving Israel on a physical level. I was obviously deepening my knowledge on the Jewish level. And I, you know, subconsciously saw what was going on around me of this, I would even call it self-dug grave of anti-truth. In other words, people are getting up these emotional ideas based on absolutely nothing, and the narratives are being brought forward by even the Israelis. Forget about, you know, the UN, and just lie on top of lie, inaccuracy on top of inaccuracy. And, you know, I was demonstrating in 1993 when Israel was signing a peace deal with the, you know, father of all terrorists, Yasser Arafat, who was getting the Nobel Peace Prize. At the time, I remember pulling my hair out, goes, what is wrong with the world? A man who threw kids off a third-story window in the north of Israel, a guy who threw a Jewish guy off a boat and lay on Klinghoffer because he was Jewish, this is who we're giving guns to? And I'm thinking, hello, people, the emperor is stark naked. Why do you think he has a beautiful suit on? And it was frustrating me, but I didn't know what to do. So I was just fighting, you know, in the IDF, you know, trying to keep Israel safe and you know, getting to little debates here and there, and life was just going on. And then several years ago, you know, I started writing like a little diary about my thoughts in the army, about only my enemies would just choose life. They'd have a beautiful life. And one day some person on, I think it was Facebook, made a comment, and I answered them back, and my answer just went like fire. It just caught on like wildfire. I'm like, wow, people are listening. Mm-hmm. So what happened was I started writing and I started debating, and I found that there's a tremendous amount of ignorance. And I couldn't decide whether the majority was evil, you know, lying, or the majority was just ignorant. And you know, when you show a picture of a dead baby from the Gaza Strip, and I'm going, well, it's not my fault. I lose, right? Because a dead baby is, you know, that's mm-hmm. emotional. Mm-hmm. And I found that the people from the Israeli side were having a hard time opening their mouths out of our emotions for the dead people, you know, because Jews is known to be compassionate people. And doesn't matter who's dying, you know, we're not happy about death, unlike, you know, our enemies. So what happened was someone gave me a call from Tel Aviv one day and said, hey, Ari, how would you like to be a guest on our show? And I was like, wow, TV, you know, look at me. Right. You know? So I went on the show, and there was a right winger against a left winger, and they were debating and they were screaming at each other. And I politely asked the right winger, do you mind if I take the stage for just 2 minutes? Because, you know, they were both emotionally arguing with each other. And nobody was actually bringing facts. And, you know, I actually studied the facts, not because of school, but I wanted to know. So the right winger said to me, absolutely, for sure. And I turned to the left winger on the show and I said, listen, I got a couple of questions for you. And I laid out some basic questions, to which he started stuttering. He literally swallowed his tongue. Like he had no answers. Mm-hmm. So the ratings of this TV show went through the roof that night, through the roof, which I was like, cool, you know, all right. And then they invited me back 2 weeks later. And the right winger says to me, what, you want the stage again? I said, well, if you don't mind. And she said, okay. And I went to another left winger. And again, the same thing happened. And again, I wasn't getting emotional. I wasn't screaming. I mean, I'll tell you the 4 points, which I continually go over and over again with these left wingers. And again, the ratings went through the roof. So a week later, I get a call from the TV station and said, how would you like to host the show? And I was like, what? Yeah, what? And they basically got rid of, you know, they got rid of the right winger, which I felt really bad because I know her. And I apologized. I said, no, it's not your fault. And now I host the show, which every week I debate another left winger from Israel.
So let me interrupt for just for a second. Was it Israeli Frenemies that came first, or was it Bulletproof, the radio program, that came first?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I'm not sure. And I'm not sure for a very good reason, because, and I say this as honestly as I can, all my Israel advocacy that I've done over the last couple of years, and in a couple of weeks is going to be a big exposure in terms of my anonymous persona that's online, which I'm about to blow out of the water, existed for many years. And mm-hmm. I've never gotten credit. I've never gotten money for it. I've never asked for anything for it. It has a 500,000 people on the blog, which I'm not going to announce now.
But you've got me curious. Okay, I'll be waiting for that.
I promise you, Johnny, when I do it, I will come back and give you an exclusive interview, okay?
Beautiful.
But, you know, I don't really care about my name. I don't. You know, I care that the facts get out there. I care that we break the false narrative and the anti-Israel propaganda. That's what I care about. So I'm not sure which came first. I don't know.
So both of these opportunities evolved around the same time. I watch with my sons and now with William every Friday morning. We watch Israeli Frenemies, and I have to say, one of the things that I appreciate you the most is your balanced approach. Although there's lots of heated moments and even some shouting back and forth, which yes. certainly makes it interesting, the questions are balanced, they're rational and reasonable, and really you can tell that there's a fair amount of respect between you and your co-host.
Well, we're friends after the show. The truth of the matter is, I'll let you in on a little secret that nobody knows. After the show, you usually go up to the roof and, you know, maybe have a cigarette and a cup of whiskey.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? But the point is, I'll tell you the honest truth is, you know, I have respect for anyone. And that's irrelevant of what religion or race. I don't care. My problem with the left is not that they're left. In other words, if we just had a difference of opinion, you and I, you know, you like blue, I like red, or you know, okay, we can argue and decide. The problem with the left is, while I'm a person who's, you know, serving in the army would take a bullet for this guy, and he's serving in the army might take a bullet for me, his ideology is based on kicking me out of my home. Hmm. So friends, that's very nice, but at the end of the day, he's going to come with the bulldozer.
That's right. Yeah.
And so what I say to the left is, don't make believe that you're like calm and nice and gentle and anti-violence. Your whole ideology is based on violence. Your idea is kicking me out of my home because I'm Jewish. Hmm. And so he says, for the sake of peace. I said, the last person who spoke about kicking Jews out of their homes for the sake of peace was not really a good man. So, you know, that's my balance. So I try to keep civil. But a lot of times when the screaming happens, I say to them, look, guys, I'm not interested. I have facts to back my claims up. I'm not interested in screaming with you. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the times they deflect the questions and whatnot. So that was the Israeli Frenemies. And I really have a good time. And my goal is not necessarily to convince my, you know, my political enemies, right? It's really frenemies, right? Convince him or change his mind. My goal is to educate the people watching. And we have millions of people watching the show.
That's right. Now, Bulletproof, on the other hand, is you solo, and is it more you presenting current events that are happening in Israel and how they pertain to the left and right politics? Is this more what Bulletproof is?
Well, Bulletproof, again, you know, I got a call from Tamar, you know, the manager of Israel News Talk Radio. Yeah. I said, sure, I'll do a show, no problem. Now, Bulletproof was not my name. I don't do that ever. Bulletproof was actually Tamar's idea.
Right.
But the reason that she chose the name, which was a good reason, was because I told her, when she said what your show was going to be about, I said, I'm so sick and tired of the lack of knowledge and the blatant lies and propaganda against Israel. And I said to her, nobody can fight me. In other words, it's not that I'm so stronger than anyone else, but I'm using facts. And there's no two truths about it. There's one truth. And so, you know, as MC Hammer said, you can't touch this. You know what I'm saying? It's not that me... You know, it's not me. I'm not,
I can't believe you can just quoted MC Hammer.
I'm sorry. You can touch me, right? I'm obviously not bulletproof, but the claims are solid because I'm not giving you my emotion or my opinions. I'm giving you facts. That's why she said bulletproof. So I said, okay. So bulletproof basically is to, you know, my tagline on the show is discover, expose, and destroy anti-Israel propaganda coming from around the world, including in Israel, unfortunately. For the last month and a half, even 2 months, I literally had to focus inside Israel. You know, I'll give you a perfect example, right? Everyone got upset that UNESCO said that Jerusalem has no Jewish history to it. Mm. Everyone got so furious. I laughed at it, not because I thought it was funny. I said, Israel's upholding a policy that if a Jew goes up on the Temple Mount and prays, the Israeli police arrest them. So what do you want from UNESCO? In other words, of course they're wrong, but, you know, King Solomon, right? King Solomon, two women come in front of King Solomon with a baby. Each one claims it's her baby, right? How does King Solomon decide the court case? He said the woman who does not want to cut the baby in half, that's who the baby belongs to. Yeah. So while Israel's trying to be apologetic and say, well, let's split up the land of Israel, even though we have a national, religious, and historic right to the land, and the Palestinian narrative is a fabricated narrative, we say split it up, and the Arabs say no. So what do you want from the world? You want the world to say, well, it belongs to the Jews, even though they're willing to give it up? It doesn't make any sense. So I have to really pull, you know, to talk about my home base often, unfortunately. But, I'll finish with this, and then we'll move on. I do believe that it took, in 93, Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres, rest in peace, signed a horrible treaty with Yasser Arafat. Mm-hmm. And the giving up of land is just the tip of the iceberg. The real effect of the Oslo Accords was not the land giving up. It wasn't even the guns given to Yasser Arafat and his brute squad. The real effect of the Oslo Accords, what we really did is we signed a lie. In other words, everything else can be fixed. But the lie that we signed, basically what Rabin and Peres did was we signed a contract in blood saying, you know what, Palestinian narrative, even though we know that you're based on a fabrication of history, let me sign the dotted line and actually, you know, put like a kosher sign. Let me give you credence for it.
That's a really good way to put it, to put a kosher sign on that. Now, you mentioned narratives and anti-truth. You mentioned, is it just ignorance or is it just anti-Semitism? But I want to go back a little bit further than where you are in history. Can you explain, for those who really don't understand the situation, would you be able to simplify it? Because, you know, sometimes people talk about, they say, you know, there never was a Palestinian people, but then they say, but Israel was known as Palestine. Oh, but it was Jewish. Now, can you just bring us back in history and simplify this for us?
Sure. Okay. And this is really important. And again, before I begin, I just want to tell you, it's like that old story of the emperor's new clothes, where everybody's looking and says, oh, it's so beautiful. And I thought the little boy going, hello, he's naked. Like the baby was, what are you talking about? And everyone looks at me like I'm the weirdo. So what I'm going to do is I really want to give the facts, okay? And we'll talk about a solution afterwards. I say to people, you want to talk about a solution, first you got to define the problem. You can offer, you know, any nice solutions you want, but if it's not based actually on the problem, it's not going to cause anything good. It'll probably cause something tragic. So let's just get the facts, okay? In the Bible, in the Torah, in the Tanakh, in the full Bible, the Philistines are mentioned, okay? Now, the Philistines themselves were sea people. Off the Gaza Strip from Greece, they were sea people. The Hebrew name Plishti, Pileshet in Hebrew, means intruder. Mm-hmm. That's the word, Pileshet, Liflosh, means to intrude. So they were sea people who intruded the land of Israel. Okay? Now, that was the story of Samson who destroyed the Plishtim. They weren't around anymore. Okay? This has nothing to do with those pagan, non-Semitic people. They came from the line of not of Shem, of Noah's son Shemite, but came from the line of Ham. Mm-hmm. So they're not Semites even by their own definition. So we're not talking about the Arabs who claim that they're Semites. So I don't want to connect the two. So what happened was the following. In 70 AD, you know, the temple, Romans destroyed the temple, and they ransacked an area which was known as Judea. Now, when you're ransacking an area called Judea, and you want to say that the Jews have no rights to Judea, that's a little difficult. Let me say that slowly. The Jews have no right to Judea? It sounds almost ludicrous. So what they did, what the Romans did, was they changed the name from Judea to Capitolina Palestina.
Right.
Okay, and they coined that name Palestina.
That was Hadrian, Emperor Hadrian.
Right. The name itself, and again, this is so important to understand, the change in the name from Judea to Palestine was an attempt by the Romans to delete and strip the Jews of their religious, national, and historic right to the land of Israel and Judea. It was an attempt to delete it. Now, that was, again, back in the Roman times. Now, time went on, and Palestine became a geographical area which included northern, from northern Syria all the way down. It was a huge geographical area. And it was never a Arab, you know, entity or an Arab country or even an Arab, you know, empire. The Ottoman Empire was the Ottoman Empire. There was no Palestinian Empire. There was no such thing. Now, to fast forward, because from the Romans till 1964, it just wasn't anything Arab. Now, after the World War One, okay, after the Ottoman Empire was taken apart, France took over the northern part of what you would say geographical Palestine, which was the Middle East, and Britain, England, took over the southern part, which, you know, Israel, Lebanon, and everything else. Okay, so it was called the British Mandate of Palestine. Okay, but again, not because it was a Palestine country or Palestine Arab, anyway, it was a geographical area. Okay.
Now, by the way, let me interrupt just for a second there, because that's where the Aussies come in, and we were there in October of last year for the Battle of the 100 year commemorations of the Battle of Beersheba, where the Australian Light Horsemen broke through the lines and took the world in Beersheba, which opened up the way to take Jerusalem. In fact, the Ottomans surrendered Jerusalem, and that was the end of the Ottoman Empire, and thus began the British occupation.
Right. So I definitely, listen, I have to tell you, I definitely like the Aussies better than the British. But, so we're talking about between 1917, you know, the Balfour Declaration, the British who were governing the area, and League of Nations knew the British were there, basically in 1917, signed a Balfour Declaration. And the Balfour Declaration, Lord Balfour, said the Jews have a right for a homeland in Palestine. Now, in Palestine didn't only mean a little strip of area that we're in today. It included the area of Transjordan. Transjordan, for those of you, you got to look at a map, is the other side. Trans is the other side of the Jordan River, right? Which is around 300 times the size of Israel today. So that whole area was for the Jewish homeland. That was 1917, I think it was. Now, 1922, I'm going to do this fast. I know it's a lot of history.
No, you're 1922, right.
The Hashemite family, clan. The Arabs are clans. They don't, they're not united. They're clans, and they hate each other. The Hashemite clan came in from Mecca and took over the area of Transjordan. Now, there was no Jordan state. There was Jordan, Israel 70, Jordan 72. There was no ancient Jordan state. It didn't exist. Okay, in Hebrew, it's called Ever HaYodin, the other side of the Jordan River, which in the British time, known as Transjordan. Now, they took over in 1922, and they started, you know, ruling over the lands, even though they had nothing to do with it. There was no history of them. There was no nationalism or religious right to these Hashemites coming from Mecca, taking over that land. That was 1922. Then I think it was 1946. The world said, okay, we're going to create a state of Jordan. It's yours, right? They can occupy it, no problem. And they gave them the right to Jordan. Why? There's no reason for it, okay? That was in 1946. Now, between that time and 1948, the Declaration of Israel, the British were ruling this area, this mandate of Palestine, and anything before 1948 that was called Palestinian, and this is really key for everybody out there, was Jewish. In other words, I'm going to name you a couple of things. The Palestine Post is today the Jerusalem Post. It was a Jewish Zionist newspaper. The Palestine Brigade was a Jewish brigade that fought the British against the Nazis. The Muslims in the area were fighting with the Nazis. Okay, the Palestine Company was a Jewish company. The Palestine Philharmonic was a Jewish Philharmonic. The Palestine football team was a Jewish football team that actually played in France in 1939, I think it was, and their flag was the Star of David.
Right.
The Palestine Pound, which the anti-Israel, you know, crowd loved to use to show that Palestine existed, was a British bill minted in Britain for the residents in the British Mandate of Palestine. On that bill, it did say Palestine because it was the British Mandate of Palestine. It says in Hebrew, mind you, land Eretz Israel, land of Israel. Now, if someone out there from any of the Muslim countries or the Arab countries will show me a bill they would ever print Hebrew on it, we'll talk. Right. I mean, really. So, you know, really. And they show coins. Again, these coins were minted for the population. Now, the Arabs actually boycotted this currency because of the mention of the land of Israel. They didn't use it. And they hated the name Palestinian. In other words, it was nothing nationally Arab. In fact, during the Ottoman Empire, there was an Arab revolt. It was called the Arab Revolt, not the Palestinian Revolt. There was no Arab entity ever in the history of the world called Palestinian. There was no Arab country. There was no Arab state. There was no Arab land. It just didn't exist. Now, I've put my whole political ideology and beliefs on this. I've offered money up to $10,000. If anyone out there can show me any time in history when there was an Arab place, land, state, entity, or anything else called Palestinian before 1948, there was only one example was the All-Palestine Government, which was actually an Egyptian puppet little state in the area, which was disbanded by the Egyptians 3 years later. And it wasn't Palestinians, it wasn't Arabs from here, it was Egyptian Arabs. So there was no such thing. 1948, right? The 47th Partition Plan, Resolution 181, which again, the Arabs love to mention, but they forget to mention that they're the ones who refused it. Mm-hmm. The Partition Plan, the UN, Britain gave the mandate over to the UN. The UN offered a partition plan. It's called Resolution 181, okay? The Jews, just hungry for their land back and hungry to live as we always are, said, okay, we'll take it. It didn't include Jerusalem. It left us most of the desert land, and there was nothing here. The Arabs, not the Palestinians again, there's no mention of them in the Resolution 181. It was given to the Arab League, not to the Palestinians. There was no entity. The resolution said a Jewish country and an Arab country in Palestine. There's no mention of a Palestine country, no mention of Palestinians, nothing. The Jews accepted the resolution. The Arab League said no. We declared a state. The Arabs attacked Israel. Right. 1948, the independence war was won by the Jews. Now, when I say it was won by the Jews, what does that mean? It means we didn't die. Mm-hmm. Right? That's what it means. Doesn't mean we captured land. No, we actually lost land. We actually lost land in 1948. So the geographical map of Israel after the 1948 war looked like the following. Jerusalem, Judea and Samaria, Gaza Strip, and the Golan Heights were all in Arab control. Mm-hmm. Okay? Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria were governed by Jordan. Now, at that time, what Jordan did in Jerusalem, remember, Jordan is 72 years old, and they have no right to their land. They occupied it. Mm-hmm. They put a wall in Jerusalem and said, Jews cannot come to the old city. That is the first time in history there became an East and West Jerusalem.
Right.
In other words, everybody talking about a peace process of East and West Jerusalem, you're actually asking to bring back a situation which is really apartheid or anti-Semitic, any way you want to put it, where it was created by Jordanians, which are a foreign occupying power, who put a wall in Jerusalem, which was never split in 2,000 years, and said Jews can't come to the old city. So I love how people say, well, that's part of the peace. That's part of the peace plan. What? Bringing back an apartheid rule where Jews can't go to the old city? It's like totally ludicrous. So again, now the Arabs in those 18 years, 48 to 67, 18 years, the Arabs had control over everything that they're demanding today for the sake of peace. Okay? In 1964, remember, that's 3 years before the Six-Day War, 3 years before the word settlement ever existed. The PLO organization was born. The PLO organization, Palestine Liberation Organization, was started by Yasser Arafat, who is not even Palestinian by their own lies. He was born in Egypt. So again, I'm not, you're right. So we have Jewish leaders who were born, that's true. But the point is, this new identity in 1964 is not even by someone who was born here. So he created this organization whose first clause in their charter says the Palestinians are part of the greater Arab people. In other words, even they know they're not really a people. Mm-hmm. It's their own charter. The second clause calls for the destruction of Israel. So I ask all of you out there, okay, if the settlements and the West Bank, which we're going to get to that word in 1 second, why it's a horrible word, it's the reason that there's no peace, then what was the excuse in 1964? Where the Arabs had control over all the areas that they're demanding today, everything. What was the excuse to develop a terrorist organization with the goal of destroying Israel if Israel was not in charge of Judea, not Samaria, not Jerusalem, not Gaza, not the Golan Heights? There were no settlements. There was no anything. What was the reason then? Mm. So it's completely ludicrous. That was the first Arab Palestinian national body created in the history of the world was 1964. Okay, now I'm going to add one more thing and I'm going to stop because I can go on for hours about this, but I don't want to take too much time, your listeners. In 1948, when the war was over, remember, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, Gaza, and the Golan Heights were all in Arab control, okay? And when the Arabs decided, okay, we cannot beat Israel in 1948, right? Israel won the war. They stopped fighting. When they stopped fighting, there was an armistice line. An armistice line is a ceasefire line. It's not a border. It was never meant to be a border. It's an armistice line, okay? Can you guess what color the marker was that was drawn as that armistice line? Can you guess?
This is the green line, right?
Of course. The green line is not a line from 1967. The green line is the armistice line mm-hmm. in 1948 with Syria, Egypt, and Jordan. It has nothing to do with these people who call themselves Palestinians. Now, in 1967, when Nasser from Egypt says, I am going to destroy the mistake called Israel, and he kicked out the UN Peacekeeping Corps at the border, and he brought all his troops up to the border, Israel said, you know what? We're not going to walk like sheep to the slaughterhouse anymore. Mm. And we've preempted a strike. Now, before we struck, we called Jordan. And we said to Jordan, King Hussein, remember, King Hussein is not a king. He has no rights in this area. He just took over the end. The world said it's okay. We said, look, and remember, Jordan is ruling Jerusalem at the time. You have to remember what the geography is here. Mm. Jordan is ruling Judea, Samaria, and Jerusalem. Jews can't even go in. We called King Hussein. We said to him, look, Egypt's going to get it from us because they're trying to destroy us. We have no bone to pick with you. Stay out of the war. Jordan said, okay, no problem. Well, we destroyed Egypt in a day. You know, mm-hmm. We took out all their planes. And then, of course, Jordan, Syria, Iran, and five, six other Arab nations joined the war. Now, Jordan, again, had no reason to attack. There's none, right? And they attacked. In 6 days alone, Israel decimated, destroyed six Arab militaries. Mm. Now, you have to understand, Egypt alone, I believe the numbers are 20 soldiers to one Israeli one. We're talking about six Arab nations. And in 6 days alone, like 6 days of creation, with all due respect, we completely destroyed six Arab militaries. Now, what happened was we liberated Jerusalem, which means now there's freedom of Jews to go to the old city. Well, almost. We still keep the Temple Mount off for Jews, not we, the government. But
let's stop there for a second. When we say we, we're talking about Moshe.
Well, the Israeli military liberated Jerusalem. Moshe Dayan was one of the generals who was a very, very secular, anti-religious, left-wing. Well, he's dead. You don't want to make fun of people when they're dead, but snowflake. Mm-hmm. Okay? Well, there was a big war hero, had these insane fantasy ideas of, you know, making peace with those who want to kill us. So what he actually did, according to the stories and witness, he ran over the border and chased the Arabs back into Jerusalem, convincing them we want to live in peace. So, for instance,
this is a single moment in history that absolutely blows my mind, and it's one that we seem to maybe possibly lesser degrees, one that we or perhaps in greater degrees we seem to repeat over and over again. What is with that?
Well, I could explain it on a biblical level if you'd like to hear it.
Go for it.
Because this is a mistake that we made many times before. We made it first in the desert when God said, go up and conquer the land. Not kind to conquer. Go up and inherit the land of Israel. Go up and inherit. We did not have to fight a war. God said, go up and inherit the land. There was mm-hmm. no war that needed to be fought. And instead of Israel going up and inheriting the land, we said, oh, we can't do it. You understand? And therefore, they sent spies out. And the whole story about our suffering for years came from that. Mm-hmm. And then during the Second Temple, when there was a declaration of Koresh, he declared the Jews can go back. Most of the Jews did not come back, right? So this is a mistake we go over and over again. And here in 67, God gave us literally the Temple Mount. I mean, I'm not exaggerating here when I tell you we could have built the third temple.
Yep.
According to Judaism, I'm not talking about some Zionist Judaism. We could have built the third temple.
It was there. It was right. Waiting for us. We'd taken it. We could have done it.
Absolutely. And what basically happened was, unfortunately, once again, we gave our leader, one guy, the right to knock out that ability. And we gave away our Temple Mount and everything else. Now, I just show how crazy this is. The Lion's Gate in Jerusalem, the gate where we liberated Jerusalem from, where the Arabs, a lot of them ran, you know, they were terrified of the soldiers, terrified of Israelis. Mm. They could not believe the victory that we had. It just didn't make any sense. Mm. Today, the Lion's Gate is a gate that most Jews will not go through out of danger.
Yeah.
So you understand the effect of that. Now, what happened? So we won this land. We liberated this land. The 1948 Green Line is now has now disappeared, right? The armistice line doesn't exist because Israel liberated the areas. Mm-hmm. Now, who did we liberate the areas from? Was it the Palestinians? No.
We weren't attacked by the Palestinians. The Palestinians didn't exist. We were attacked by Egypt, Jordan, Syria. Is that fair?
There you go. The Green Line is from them. It has nothing to do with the Palestinians. Now, what's the West Bank? Everybody loves using that word, the West Bank. What's the West Bank? The West Bank is the West Bank of the Jordan River. What's west of the Jordan River? What's the name of that state that exists on the west of the Jordan River? It's called Israel. Hebron is nowhere near the West Bank of the Jordan River. Jerusalem is nowhere near the West Bank of the Jordan River.
Right.
Nablus, these places are nowhere near the Jordan River. They say the West Bank, they're talking about Israel. What does Jerusalem have to do with the Jordan River? There's nothing, no connection. So they use this language to put everything into one category, and we unfortunately accept it. Mm. Right? Now, there's no, and again, I'll say this as clearly as possible, there is no justified Palestinian claim to the Green Line. It has nothing to do with them. Zero. Zero. So that when I say to people, and I'll sum up, when I say to people that this whole Palestinian narrative is fake, it just doesn't have a basis. To which people usually respond to me, okay, but we have a problem today. No, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't. I say to people, don't base your opinion on some fabricated national historic claim, and when I prove that claim false, say, well, we have a problem now. That's ridiculous. That's dishonest. The problem exists not because of your false narrative. The Arabs are living out the result of their own belligerence towards Israel. In other words, the Israeli Arabs, the Jews, the Christians in Israel, they have a beautiful life. Muslims in Israel are the highest educated Muslims in most of the Middle East. So the Arabs in Gaza, okay, if they're suffering, they're suffering because their own idiocy of voting in a radical, genocidal, terrorist Muslim organization to govern them. It's not because of Israel. So, now the refugees, and I'm going to finish off with this, you could continue. The refugee problem. UNRWA, refugees. UNRWA is the Palestinian refugee organization. It's the only refugee situation that has their own organization. And they are the wealthiest organization in the world.
Yeah.
Africans are starving. Refugee camps in Israel, and anybody who comes to Israel, I'll be happy to take you through a tour. Every house, they have a satellite dish on top. They have stores inside the refugee, quote-unquote, refugee camps. They drive in cars. They're not starving. It's just ridiculous. Now, who created the refugee problem? The refugee camps. Israel never built a refugee camp in the history of the world, ever. In 1948, when Jordan took over Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria, and Egypt took over the Gaza Strip, and Syria took over the Golan Heights, okay? So what they did was they took local Arabs and shoved them in these. They built the camps, not us. And now it's their own brothers, right? Their own brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. Israel got refugees from Europe in the Holocaust, and we gave them a hug and took them in. They took their brothers and threw them in camps. Why they do this? Because their hatred towards Israel is more important to them than the care for their own brothers. So they developed a refugee problem so you can point a finger at Israel. It's absolutely cruel. That's why I said if people say they're left and they're human rights, they care about human rights like I care about the price of tea in China. They just don't care about human rights. What happened was, for instance, the Iraqi leader at the time of the 1948 war, okay? Remember, Arabs were attacking Israel, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. Before they attacked Iraq, the leader of Iraq sent a message to the Arabs, the local Arabs, said, leave your homes. We're going to come in and destroy all of Israel. And by the way, this is not me. This is on record. You can read the quotes. We're going to destroy this small Jewish state, and then you can have all the land back. So a lot of people left, Lebanon and Syria and their Arab neighbors, thinking, and they put them in these little camps for what they thought, maybe they thought it would be like a couple of days because, they'll destroy Israel in 2 days. How could they not win a war against refugees coming from the Holocaust and the Sephardi Jews coming in from Arab lands who are farmers? We're going to destroy them in a second, our mighty Muslim and Arab strength. Mm-hmm. So they figured it might be a couple of days. So they put them in these camps wherever they were, and Israel won the war. So those camps, instead of Lebanon saying, okay, the Jews won, you're our brothers, come be citizens of Lebanon. No, they didn't do that. He said, nope, stay in the camps. So the camps now still exist in Lebanon and Egypt. Same thing.
So let me get it straight. So there's Palestinian camps in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria and Jordan? And they claim
Jordan, the answer is yes. Jordan is even the more ironic situation. Remember, Transjordan, remember what I said about Transjordan? Transjordan was part of geographical Palestine. So technically, the state of Jordan sits on approximately 73% of what was geographical Palestine. Mm-hmm. Listen, this is very important to what I'm about to tell you. It's going to blow your mind. The state of Jordan, the new state of Jordan, the 72-year-old state of Jordan, sits on 73% of the land that was geographical Palestine. The population in Jordan is around 75 to 76% of the Arabs who define themselves as Palestinians. So which means, if this was really about building a state called Palestine and they want their historic Palestine back, well, why aren't they fighting the Jordanians, who are completely a foreign occupying power, over 75% of the land of Palestine, where they're already a majority, instead of fighting Israel, which is a tiny sliver, where they're a minority?
That's a fair point. So now listen, you mentioned four points that you go over, and I suspect that we probably just covered them all. Is that right?
I'll say them very quickly. Number one, there was never an Arab entity, country, land, state, or anything else called Palestine pre-Israel. Okay, the occupation simply did not happen in terms of Palestine. And again, they like mixing up. You're occupying people, you're not occupying land. They love switching between those things. No, the international claim is that we occupied land, and that simply did not happen. Okay? Jerusalem was never in the history of the world an Arab capital city. Their demand to make Jerusalem an Arab capital city is a complete and total excuse and fabrication. I will pay anyone $10,000 and raise a Palestinian flag on my house if you can give me the year when Jerusalem was ever an Arab, forget Palestine, an Arab capital. Forget Palestine. Never existed. Okay? Four, Jerusalem was never even a holy Muslim city. Mm-hmm. Again, in other words, what? How could you say that? Let me say it again. Jerusalem was never a holy Muslim city. You want my proof? One, it's not mentioned in the Quran. Two, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which, you know, they say is now on the Temple Mount, did not exist in the time of Muhammad. In the time of Muhammad, there were no Muslims in Israel or in Jerusalem at all. In the times of Muhammad, in the Quran itself, it talks about two mosques that were in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. One was the mosque that was near Muhammad, and one was the farthest away from him. Mm-hmm. The Al-Aqsa means the farthest place. That's what it means. It does not mean Jerusalem. So the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the time of Muhammad was in Saudi Arabia. The truth of the matter is, after like 100 years after Muhammad died, so there was a little friction within the Muslim world, you know, leadership. Now, they originally faced Jerusalem because you have to remember, you really have to remember this. After the Jews built the temple in Jerusalem, whatnot, then after the Romans took over and Christianity became, so Christianity also faced Jerusalem. Remember, the first Christians came out of Judaism, right? Mm-hmm. Jesus was Jewish, right? So they also looked at the temple as a holy place. There was no new place in Jesus' time to worship, okay? So when the Muslims began in the 7th century, the only really holy place in the Middle East was Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. So they faced Jerusalem originally. Then came, I don't remember his name now by heart. He built this Al-Aqsa Mosque on the corner of the Temple Mount, not in the middle. The Gold Dome is not the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Gold Dome is something else. I'll explain in a second. They built a mosque on the right corner side of the Temple Mount, okay? And what happened was there was friction, political friction within Islam. So what they did was they turned their backs in Jerusalem and now started facing Mecca. They didn't want to give that guy power who built a mosque in Jerusalem. Now, can you for those listening, this is really, if you're not sitting down and you're drinking some hot coffee, please put it down right now, okay? The name of the mosque in Jerusalem when they first built it was called Beit al-Mukdas in Arabic. For those of you who know Hebrew, that says Beit HaMikdash. Beit HaMikdash in Hebrew and English means
House of
the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. Mm. The Arabs called it Beit al-Mukdas because there was no argument that it was built on the Temple Mount. And when they built the Al-Aqsa Mosque, it wasn't even so much against the Jews. It was just built on a holy place. And then 100 years later, they built the Gold Dome. It has nothing to do with the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Right?
So, and the only thing that was ever holy in Jerusalem to the Muslims was the mosque itself. That's it. Hmm. The whole idea of Muhammad taking a dream with his donkey up this and that, way later. His journey never was in Jerusalem. It was in Al-Aqsa. It was the other mosque in Saudi Arabia. The tradition of Jerusalem came after he died. It's not in the Quran even. So the whole thing is fabrication. Now, I respect anyone's religion, and again, whatever one believes is there, but you cannot claim rights on stuff that's mine, okay? Not even based on your religion, based on lies that you told after your religion was created. That's just not going to work for me, you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Talking about the Temple Mount, 2 years ago I was there, and I did ascend the Temple Mount, and it was extremely hostile. I was shocked, actually, at how hostile it was. And last year, when I ascended, it was much calmer. The situation is still not ideal, but it was after the event of the terrorists that made it onto the Temple Mount with the guns. Right. And it was not anywhere near as hostile as the year before.
I think the friction on the Temple Mount is a little bit our fault. In other words, God's really saying, you know, nation of Israel, Jews, you know, if you don't want to accept, you know, my present to you, you know, and it says it in the Torah, it says in the Bible, if you try to make peace with those who want to destroy you, they will be the word in Yudachal Mokesh in Hebrew is it means they'll be a bomb for you. They'll be your death. Mm-hmm. So, you know, listen, you know, God gives you daddy gives you a present, and you mezuzel. You don't take the present. You really shame, you know. So right now, the situation is quote unquote calm, right? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? We're not dying, but it's really not you know, things are immoral. I don't care if people are dying or not. I do care, obviously, but if things are immoral, they have to be fixed. Right now, the situation on the Temple Mount is an unethical, immoral situation, mm-hmm. and it has to be fixed. And until we do, there's no question in my mind that we're going to keep paying, unfortunately, the price for that. But you know, I went up there once in my life. I went up there once in my life, and I was crying. I have a video of it. You know, someone took a video of me. Tears are coming down. Hmm. But the tears were not coming down because, you know, the Assyrians are destroying us, or because the Nazis are destroying us, or because the Romans are. Tears are coming down because we're doing this to ourselves. Hmm. And I kept on saying to myself, you know, how much longer? You know, when are we going to stand up for ourselves? We're not in the ghetto anymore.
No, that's
why
right.
Are we, you know, why are we so scared to stand up for ourselves, to stand up for what's right and truthful? That makes me more frustrated and scared, you know, sad than anything else.
Moving forward, standing together 24/7 IDF, this is who you represent these days. It's the motto is making a difference to those who make a difference in Israel and helping the world express gratitude to those who keep Israel safe. Tell us a little bit about Standing Together.
Okay, so Standing Together is my personal therapy, and I mean that, you know, as real as I can say it. You know, I've been in the IDF reserves now for 23 years. I've been in two different wars, tens of operations. I don't know how many. I've lost and buried friends over the last 23 years. Felt the pain, felt happiness at times. In 2006, I'll make a very long story short. We were 38 somewhat kilometers into Lebanon. It's 26 miles for those of you in America. And we were pretty much ambushed by Hezbollah. Guys in my unit were guy in my unit was killed. A couple were shot up. You know, several were hit with shrapnel. And my direct officer was hit horribly, also by bullet fire, and also with shrapnel in the chest. And long story short, you know, I'm in the front with him, and he went forward and got hit, and I was evacuating him. And as I got back to where we were hiding out, the doctors jumped on him and they jumped the other guys and the medic then jumped on me. And I was like, you know, get off of me. And a huge piece of shrapnel from my mortar blew through my vest. You know, I believe you saw it when I was in Australia.
You handed around a piece of metal that was almost as big as my hand and really had quite a bit of weight to it. It was a jagged piece of metal that you handed around that was taken out of your back. Is that correct?
Not out of my back, out of my vest.
Out of
it was
best.
Taken out of my back. If it would have gone into my back, it would not have stopped. Physically, it should have cut me in half like butter without any problem. Why it stopped is beyond me. I mean, thank God. I know why it stopped. But I'm saying it doesn't make any sense. I wasn't wearing a bulletproof vest. So the war was a very it was trauma. You know, it was traumatic physically and emotionally. I'll tell all those who are not military out there, when you're in war, it's a little bit surreal. And the bullets are flying by you and whizzing by you and explosion and knocking you back and forth. It's surreal. You don't think. I can't explain it to you. When you get back home from the war, it hits you like a brick. So you want to call it PTSD. I mean, you know, some of the effects are actually positive for me. Like, I don't sleep much. I can do more work and get more things done. But some of the things are negative affecting, and I couldn't go back to work so quickly. And it was, you know, and it's not that I was ducking when a helicopter went over. It was when I heard a siren, I would charge the siren. In other words, if I know that there's danger, I will charge the danger to be there first to try to take care of the threat. Mm-hmm. And till today, if something happens in Israel, a terrorist attack or anything, and I can't be there to help, I feel guilty about that. I don't know if that makes any sense to you. Mm-hmm. But in other words, not that I think I can take care of everything, but I have a responsibility to try. And if I can't do it, I'm not trying hard enough. I went studying a couple of years to, you know, a little calm my brain. Then I did go back to high tech, which was horrible for me. Again, not that it's bad. For me, it wasn't, you know, I have a marketing degree and I, you know, at conferences, at fairs, I can get the whole audience up on their legs and screaming about, you know, a product, which I don't even believe in. And I do a good job at it also, but it just wasn't for me. I needed something, you know, to fill me up in terms of, I don't know. 3 years ago, I get a call. When we got back from Lebanon, we were broken. We were physically, emotionally, you know, And we passed over the border, and we were exhausted. We ran out of food. We ran out of water. We were dehydrated. We were hallucinating. We were seeing things. And a truck drives up to the border, and a guy gets in and goes, "What do you need?" And we look at him like, "What? You know, what? What do you need?" I said, "We need water." He goes to the back of this huge trailer, opens it up, fresh bottles of water and juice and iced coffee. It was August, remember. What do you need? Food. Pulls sandwiches out and chocolate and candies. Oh, my God. I could still taste it in my mouth. What else do you need? I said, "We haven't changed our clothing. We were drenched. It was summer. Mm. We were drenched." He pulls underwear out, shorts, T-shirts, Crocs. You know, our boots. We haven't. You have to realize we walked around I don't know, 120 kilometers over the last couple of days. Mm-hmm. Our feet were destroyed. Putting your feet in Crocs, you know what that's like. You know? Mm. I'm sorry, Crocs are free advertising here, but and then I walked over to the guy. I was looking for wings on his back. I literally thought he was an angel. I said, "Who are you?" And he says to me, "I run an organization called Standing Together, and our goal is wherever IDF soldiers are, we'll be there for them." And I said, "Well, where's all this stuff from? What are you, like a trillionaire?" And his truck was packed from top to bottom. Mm-hmm. And he was driving the border for 20 days. And he says to me, "Hold on 1 second. I can't talk to you now. I have to make pancakes." And I'm going, "Pancakes? What are you talking about?" And so he drops off in front of me a bag of thousands of letters, goes to the back of the trailer, opens up the window, and he's making pancakes on a fresh griddle. And I'm like, "What? Is this a joke?" So I open up the letters and says, "Dear IDF soldier, know that we're praying for you. We support you. We love you. Signed, Michael, Jennifer, Shlomo, Hebrew, English, Jews, non-Jews. People just sent us so much support and love. You know, I was hurt in that war, more emotion physically, but this put everything back. And I'm bringing the letters to the Israeli natives, and I'm translating it, and they're crying because we know what they say on the news, you know, about us, when we, you know, all kinds of things. To get this kind of support from people so far away, it literally saved us. So, you know, and he really, the food was delicious. The gear was great, but that support was so important for us.
And clearly, Ari, this was support you weren't expecting. You made it across the border, and then what? You were prepared to just fall down and wait for someone to find you?
I'll tell you even something more. The IDF could not fly us back to Israel. They were afraid of flying helicopters in. So we had to walk back. Mm. We walked 18 hours. We crossed over the border. They told us we have to keep walking down because they can't bring buses up to the border. We couldn't walk anywhere. We collapsed. So when this guy came up, it was a lifesaver. It was literally like someone drowning and they throw him a buoy. It was a lifesaver. There's no words that I can describe to you what it did for us.
So let me understand that Standing Together 24/7 IDF is the only organization that conducts these activities?
Yes. So what happened was over the last 2 years, the IDF has cracked down on all kinds of donations to soldiers. People were opening up all kinds of pirated donations pages, and nobody was tracking where the money's going, and nobody tracking if the soldiers got what they needed to get. So the IDF has basically said no more. No more donations to soldiers. This is ridiculous. And they closed organizations down. And you cannot, you know, give them combat gear and stuff, which has always been ridiculous. And for Standing Together, they give us full clearance. Because for 22 years, we've been doing this on the table, always with IDF clearance. So right now, they've given us clearance to go into the official IDF training areas, which are not talking on bases. We're talking about in the bush area. Now, I just want to explain that 3 years ago, I get a call from the head of this organization and says, "Hey, how would you like to help us run the organization?" I quit my job in high tech in a blink of an eye. Mm-hmm. And for the last 3 years, 25 hours a day, 9 days a week, I am doing 18, 19 hours a day, as much as I can to help support IDF soldiers on the front lines. This is something unique about us. We're not helping, again, guys in the office, the women, men and women in the office are important, but they don't need my help. We are reaching only the frontline soldiers, only the ones seeing the combat. That's not because everyone's not important, but they're the ones who need the most. And so what we're doing is, not only helping them and supporting them, we're going to everyone around the world and saying, "People, IDF are there. Hmm. Let's show them how much love, support, and appreciation we have for them from all over the world." So we have several campaigns, including the food truck that goes out daily. You know, we're buying a new truck now because the IDF has given us full clearance. We have to get to approximately 2,000 soldiers a day, so we have to buy a new truck. So we're working on that full scale right now.
You said, did you just say you have to get to 2,000 soldiers a day?
Well, we don't have to. We have clearance to get to. Right now we get to.
But you have the ability to do that with a truck?
Not the one that we have right now. We can get to around 500 to 600 a day. The new truck that we're looking at right now, and we know, including a 3-day generator or whatever it is, so we can stay in the areas for 3 days and go from base to base. That can get to 2,000 soldiers a day. And you know, it has a full kitchen inside, room for gear, room for stuff they can give to soldiers, and computers online where we can have live message being sent from whoever's donating and sponsoring, you know, and that's this new truck, you know, it's a huge 4x4. It's a huge 4x4 front with a massive thing in the back, which is, it's a one piece. It's not a two piece like we have today. So you can actually drive into the most, you know, difficult areas to get into. And we're on high gear trying to find sponsors for this new truck. You know, that's one of the major campaigns we're doing right now. I just quickly run some of the campaigns by you. The Lone Soldiers in Israel, which are soldiers who are serving the IDF when their parents or families are not in Israel. So we're flying their families in, families who can't afford it, to be at their graduations. I know as me, I was a lone soldier. Mm-hmm. I remember the tears coming down my eyes as I graduated from my basic training and none of my family was there. Mm. Not because they didn't want to come, because they're in America. Mm. So we find these people who cannot pay and we fly them in. So that this guy or this girl who's a lone soldier can enjoy their family at their graduation like every other Israeli.
Yep.
We're renting apartments in Jerusalem for 60 lone soldiers a year. And we have a volunteer base which has everything ready for them in their apartment. They don't have to do a thing. That's the second campaign. We have to go out daily. Every day we reach every 100 soldiers, it costs us $1,000. It's $10 a soldier for the food and drinks and whatever we bring to them. Mm. And we don't work. You know, the only thing we do, we have the money, we go out. We don't have the money, we can't go out. It's very simple. I'm not complaining. It's just we don't. So that's when I tell people, you got to help us. We want to get out every single day. We want to get to the most amount of soldiers. So we're running campaigns daily. I'm actually coming to North America in February on a huge speaking tour. Also in Israel Advocacy, and also obviously fundraising for Standing Together. And we need help. We need help. I mean, you know, again, I don't need help. We want to get to as many soldiers. And therefore, I'm saying to people, look, help us. Show appreciation and say thank you to the men and women of the IDF who are putting their own lives in line to support Israel. It's very simple.
That's it. Now, the website is www.stogether.org. Together.org.
S like standing. And I just want to tell everyone, we did two things just now on the website. Number one, we have a built-in crowdfunding platform where you can build your own campaign for your community, for a wedding, for an anniversary, for a birthday party, a bat mitzvah, whatever it is, church, synagogue, whatever you are, you could build your campaign. And then, you know, we'll have whatever money comes in, we make that campaign, it'll have a full send. This was from this family or this synagogue or this church or this community, whatever it is, coming from them. So you could do that. We're about to launch in another month and a half a charity campaign, which is a matching campaign. We have one pillar. We're looking for three or four other pillars to be the pillars of that campaign. And we're going to launch it, which will mean everybody donates a dollar. After that, the dollar will be worth $4. Mm. And again, here's the thing. We don't have an office. We don't spend money on an office. I'm the only person who gets a salary in the organization. Everybody else is volunteer. Right. Everybody from our accountant to a lawyer. You know, a funny story I'll tell you. We were looking for someone to design a brochure. Now, I'm the kind of guy who can't, you know, color in the circle, okay? Right. And I spoke to a graphic artist, and they said to me that they want $10,000 or $4,000 for the brochure. I said, I'm not spending $4,000, although that's what it's worth. I'm not going to use money that was donated to soldiers. So I tried to fundraise for a brochure. Nobody really wants a brochure, you know, like nobody wants to cover my salary, which I'm going crazy over every year to try to fundraise it so I don't have to take the money. Mm. And nobody wants to, you know, the site, which I tried to design myself. So when she said $4,000, I said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I sat day and night for around 2 weeks, no sleep, and designed the brochure. Mm-hmm. The website, I'm not a programmer. I'm not a graphic designer. I designed the website. It's not great. But again, so we are looking for volunteers now to do those things as well. But I would love it if we can find someone and say, you know what? You're doing great stuff. We're covering the expenses. We're covering your website. We're going to cover this and that. Because, look, I'm not doing this for money. I'm not doing this for a job. This is really, you know, what was given to me. I'm passing it forward.
So let me ask you this question. Okay, so www.stogether.org for standtogether.org, stogether.org.
You could also get to the website. Very easy. It's www.247idf.
Okay. Now listen, if people do want to volunteer, how do they contact you to do this? Do they get there through the website?
So they can do it through the website. Of course, they can, of course, check out my Facebook, Ari Fold, or they can send me an email, which is Ari, A-R-I, at stogether.org.
Okay. A-R-I at stogether.org. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put all these links on this post, so that everybody can go there. If there's people who would like to volunteer their time and effort towards Standing Together 24/7 IDF, that'd be wonderful. I'll give you a link where you can do that. If you would like to donate to Standing Together 24/7 IDF, There is a campaign link on this post for the new IDF support vehicle that Ari was talking about. That's really important, and I do very much encourage the dear listeners, and I know how generous you can be, and I hope that you would show the same generosity that you showed me 5 months ago for those who put their lives on the line to keep Israel safe. So please dig deep for the IDF and donate to Standing Together. There will be links on this post, as I said. And also, as Ari said, you can find him on Facebook, Ari Fuld, F-U-L-D, and Standing Together 24/7 IDF. You'll find that on Facebook as well. I'll put the links on this post, and you'll see videos that a lot of which are you're in, you know, you're out and about, you're on the ground, and you're supplying all sorts of stuff.
Right, and you see that every time I go out, I'm on an emotional high. You see that, and I know I never get used to this. I know what it feels like to get. I know what it feels like to receive. I will tell you that giving for me is at a much higher level. I just feel it's so satisfying. I just want to say one more thing, by the way. Those of you in North America, my next trip is to North America. February, I'll be starting the West Coast, going to the East Coast. If you want to set something up in your area, speaking engagement or an IDF for Israel Night, you can also be in touch with me and we'll do that. But please do that sooner than later, since time is of essence. If you are anywhere else in the world, I was in the Down Under a couple of months ago, which was wonderful. I definitely hope to come back there. South Africa, wherever you are in the world, if you want to set something up, you can certainly get in touch with me. We'll try to work out the logistics for that as well.
Absolutely. Ari Fuld, thank you, my friend, for coming on to Truth to You and letting us know.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me on. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks.